Hello there and welcome to the very first Quids Inn podcast. Quids Inn is a student-run investment fund full of keen trainers in search for that golden opportunity. My name is George Thompson, co-founder.
I'm Lawrence Finswan, I'm co-founder as well. We have teams, six divisions, covering equities, fixed income and FX. In the equity sector, we have we're sort of investigating companies within technology, energy, industrials, pharmaceuticals, with the potential to expand into other areas as well, financial companies. But at the moment, we're building a solid base here. And so, welcome to today. We have the energy team and the FX team. If you'd like to introduce yourselves quickly and say which team you're on.
I'm Michael Roussos. I am on the currency team.
I'm Ricardo Lovo, and I'm still on the currency team.
Matthias Nilsson, and I'm on the energy team.
I'm Paul Burton, and I'm on the energy team as well.
Brilliant. Well, a good bunch of people we have here in the studio today. So this podcast gives you the opportunity to hear what trades the team have been considering and what's been going on in the world economy. Their job is to try and convince you, the listener, that they are on to a winner. Next week, the fund will decide what trades it should invest in, and the panel's performance tonight will play a part in that decision. So no pressure, guys. Right, please bear in mind that all that is said on the podcast tonight is for educational and enjoyment purposes only, so don't take it as personal investment advice.
Well, before we get to the companies and currencies that we're discussing, it's important to sort of consider the wider macro field and the wider macro outlook of the global economy. To begin with, we'll each sort of select a particular area that we're going to sort of briefly overrun and just sort of round up this macro environment. Well, I'll go first then. So I'm covering sort of China quickly. We've seen sort of prolonged sort of reduction in growth and output from China. They're really struggling with this sort of domestic driven economy and sort of really struggling this adjustment towards this domestic economy. And we've seen sort of, although we've seen, you know, there's still strong growth figures. I mean, the highest we've ever particularly seen from any country ever. But they're definitely reducing down, and it's quite actually hard to sort of study and trust Chinese statistics. So potentially we could actually see a much lower growth figure than they really do suggest. And I think what is key for China is that through this adjustment, they don't suffer a hard landing and sort of, you know, get this adjustment process really wrong and end up going through to recession or sort of, and sort of have to manage their, also they have to manage their currencies sort of very well during this process as well.
Right, so I'm actually going over to the euro. The euro as a currency has been the second best performing currency for, in 2016 up until February, but on the 10th of March, in a couple of days, and the ECB is going to be announcing what kind of monetary policy it's going to be following, and due to this date, we have seen the euro against the dollar starting to lose some of its value. So the ECB is mainly going to be focusing on what kind of unconventional monetary policy tools are going to be used. Draghi will be discussing whether he's going to be cutting the deposit rate, how much, and whether he's going to be changing the quantitative easing program, and or whether he's going to extend the period. So definitely look out for that. As I mentioned earlier, the euro has started losing value, so shorting the euro at the moment, it can be quite risky. Don't expect that the ECB is going to present a strong program. It might disappoint the markets. By disappointing the markets, I mean it might not present a big cut in its deposit rate, or it might not present a large change in its quantitative easing program. And if this is the case, then we're definitely going to see a rebound in the value of the euro. So just something to keep in mind.
Today I would like to start talking about a really interesting correlation between the currencies and the energy market. As we have here the energy team, I will really like to ask a question, because I've seen that the Australian dollar is strictly correlated with the energy prices and the commodity prices in general. And so we've seen a recovery of the oil price in particular, and this affected the market, the forex market, and we together with the GDP of the growth of GDP of 3% was unexpected, was actually a positive news for the for Australia. And so we've seen this recovery, but it seems that the Australian dollar is being overbought at the moment. So I would like to ask a question to understand more about the future of this currency. I need to understand first what's gonna happen in the energy prices in general and commodities.
Well, oil prices, although they have seen a small increase now recently, they're not very likely to keep this increase as the supply, it's not going to cut the supply. Because we see institutions such as OPEC not wanting to put a roof on the output of the members, and the new additions to the oil market such as Iran that just came out of sanctions.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is to avoid long on the Australian dollar, because otherwise, because the recovery of the oil price and the energy price is not gonna have a good impact on that, and you're saying that it's better lead into other markets or even shorting the Australian dollar, right?
Yeah, but in the long run, definitely, we will see some kind of recovery as supply is eventually going to meet demand because of it's such a commodity that's used every day, and you know it's not going to last forever. And in the long run, definitely the price will recover, if not to its previous rate, but it will get out of this lull.
All right, thank you very much.
And I've been looking at a story today, basically surrounding the whole Brexit uncertainty situation, where Mike Carney has actually come out and stated his position in a select committee, and he's said that Britain is better in the EU for several economic reasons, which he's outlined, which I think's very interesting, especially with Boris Johnson recently stating his position. He's going against that, and it'll be interesting to see where the argument goes.
Yeah, there's definitely many conservative Eurosceptics who are a bit annoyed about that announcement today. Right, interesting stuff, guys. Thank you very much for that roundup of the economy. And now we're going to move on to our divisions.
Okay, now moving on to the energy team. We're going to discuss the macro factors, their effects on their economy and their sort of industry, but also particular companies, which we'll move on to later. So firstly, how do you think the low oil prices into 2016 have affected your companies and your industry in general?
Okay, well, I mean, it's been a pretty tough time for oil and gas. I mean, it's just we've been trying to really search really hard for the sort of conventional energy sources. And obviously, since January, we've seen some massive declines, despite even in the last week with oil prices recovering a little bit. There's still not many opportunities. So you'll see tonight when we present our companies just how many renewables and alternative energy companies we will be presenting, because that is just where the growth is at the moment.
In general, though, the solar industry is a very profitable industry at the moment, with the main factor being that very few electricity generating stations are actually fueled by oil. They've got so many alternatives now that the actual oil prices have little impact on that industry in particular. And also China have invested a huge amount into solar, and for example, like a country like Morocco, it's actually cheaper for them to use solar than to use oil. So it says a lot, really.
Which countries do you think are particularly affected by the low oil prices? Just the exporters, or also producers of primary goods as well?
Well, exporters are definitely affected by the lower price, as they now have like less revenue from their oil. But it's also affecting positively importers of oil, like Japan, that had to import most of its oil and now can use that money for elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, economic theory goes generally, if oil prices are falling, it's a good thing for the economy. It leads to more growth, because generally, if consumers have more money in their pocket because they're spending less on petrol, then they're going to spend more than, say, Saudi Arabia does when they've got higher oil prices, producing more. So we should see, over time, the predictions say that actually we're going to be seeing more growth from the lower oil prices. But definitely, you've got to keep in mind the sort of political instability with Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia. This is a whole tectonic tectonic shifting thanks to this low oil price that the effects are going to be seen.
Have we seen much parity or sort of correlation between equity markets and oil markets then, and oil prices?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would say there's a link in confidence. So, I mean, it's obviously not completely direct. And, for example, just last week, the US announced that they had the biggest inventories of oil on record. And despite that fact, oil prices have recovered. So the relationship is a bit, it's not exactly one-to-one relationship, but there's definitely confidence. Oil is so important politically and economically that definitely there is an effect on the wider market.
How strong do you see this recovery that we've seen in the last week in terms of oil prices?
In the long run, I don't think it's going to continue really, because it's going to take a while. As Iran have recently mentioned that they've got huge supplies. They've got 500,000 barrels that they're prepared to put onto the market, and it's going to eventually reach over a million. And with the world already oversupplied, this huge influx is just going to push the price back down, in my opinion.
Well, moving on, you mentioned that the majority of your companies you're proposing today are renewable energy-based companies. Do you think the recent sort of Paris climate talks have sort of fueled this choice, or do you think that this is really just a growth sector with low oil prices and these talks combined?
Well, it's a combination of the two, because there has been going the years before a lot of more technology into lowering the prices of renewables, but also the Paris conference puts a legal binding to countries to actually push forward with this, and also a sense of responsibility for the more the richer countries to help out poorer countries in developing their renewables.
Would you like to present your companies now, then?
All right. So in the renewable sector, there's a company that really stands out, and this is Gamesa. It's a Spanish manufacturer of wind turbines. And they have some clear advantages, and that's that they've specialized in a niche of low to mild wind turbines and really excelled in the field. And they're recognized globally, and their turbines are top ranking in several lists for a few years. This has helped them to establish in emerging markets, such as Brazil, India, but also China, which is not very common for European wind turbine manufacturers. These are important markets, not only because of the size of the countries, but these countries are some of the countries that install most wind turbines a year. This is something that Siemens has also been looking into, and has led them to engage in merger talks with Gamesa since late January this year. Also, the quantitative data shows an upward trend, as their revenue has been steadily growing since 2012, and in the year 2015, they grew by 23% in revenue.
So by the sounds of it, their growth seems to be sort of partly fueled not only by sort of this resurgence in renewable energy and this growth in renewable energy, but their sort of technology that seems to outperform the market. Would you suggest that this is true, and that this company, based also on their sort of their figures and their financial figures, that they will outperform the market in comparison?
Yeah, it's likely, because they're one of the leading technologies. They have some of the leading technologies for especially low to mild wind turbine markets, which is not very common for wind turbine manufacturers.
Are there any potential risks you see from this trade?
Well, since it has established very, very globally recently, it won't have the same risk that it had earlier in 2012, where it saw kind of a crash as Spain cut substitutes for it. But now it's established globally and it's strong, and mergers talks with Siemens would make it the largest manufacturer in the world with 15% of the market share.
So you think that this sort of merger as well with Siemens will really help it boost its sales?
Definitely, definitely.
Cut costs and reduce its sort of marginal costs.
Definitely. It will likely go through, but some implications with a former partnership with French Areva might cause some difficulties. But
do you think there'll be a change in the management structure within the firm? maybe some Siemens executives coming across.
Well, yeah, since Siemens will be the larger owner of the company, there will probably be some Siemens representative or management.
Okay, well, that sounds like a really strong idea. Has anyone else got any other questions to counter the investment idea? Okay. No, then we'll move on to the next company. I think that's Paul.
Yep. I've been looking at a company. It's a oil refinery company. It's called Western Refining. And basically, it focuses on refining crude oil into gasoline, diesel fuel and jet fuel, things like that. It's got some really strong fundamentals, which I've been looking at. It's traded up 6.21% in the past week, which is well ahead of the S&P 500, which is only increased 3.67%. It's been traded in very high volume, with almost 3 million shares trading hands on last Thursday alone. And also its gross profit is positive. It's 102.25 million, and that's set to increase in the next quarter. And also, in recently in December, they announced a merger with Northern Tier Energy, which is set to result in a combined entity owning three of the most profitable independent refineries. And this type of integration is going to be beneficial for the firm and for their profits in the long run. Also, analysts have been emphasising that the outperform rating of the stock, and they've now boosted the target of the stock to $40, and it's currently sitting on around 29. So that's definitely something positive to look at. So yeah, it looks like a great.
Mm. Well, I actually looked at the company that they're set to merge with during my sort of the recruitment season, sort of preparation for interviews last year.
Yeah.
Do you think that although this merger set to go through and they've got strong financial figures, they will be sort of negatively affected by low oil prices, low sort of demand for oil. Really, they'll be producing less through the refinery. Mm. I think this could be a potential risk. And how do you think they mitigate it?
Well, the way I looked at it is kind of like an inverse relationship between the two. Obviously, the demand for the refinery is still there despite the low oil prices, and they've actually benefited in some cases from the price lull. And also kind of this stock in particular seems to have kind of bottomed out now, and now there seems to be an upward trend which you can see. So hopefully the effect won't be too big.
Are there any interesting management decisions or management sort of strategies that are coming forward, sort of growth strategies they have?
They've made some significant investments in recent years. One, I found the Bobcat pipeline project in 2015. So basically, this is all about the company gaining greater ability to move crude oil around the world globally. So there's definitely some expansion there despite economic macro struggles.
Mm. I suppose you've always got the competition with sort of the OPEC group of oil producers, and no one really wants to lower their production, so they're all just seeming to sort of increase production and sort of boost output, which I can see the potential for that trade. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Has anyone else got any other questions for Paul regarding? Okay, we'll move on to the final energy company that's been proposed. George has got this one.
Yep, so I'm speaking in for Robbie, who sadly is at home this week, but he's proposed the company called Canadian Solar. So we're trying to capitalise on the massive growth in solar at the moment, not only in the USA, which the USA solar stocks has increased 20% last year and already up 10% this year, but this is a Canadian solar company, and the particular benefit for this company is vertically integrated. So it manufactures everything from the individual solar cells themselves to the specialised off-grid sort of individual home applications to whole utility scale solar plants. So they've really got a diversified portfolio, which means they're going to be able to capitalise on growth in all sort of areas. And similar sort of thing as Matthias brought to us, the sort of Canadian solar's done really well in China. It's really expanded in many developing countries, not only in America, which is very strong as well. And also keeping that competitive edge, the research team is very effective there. It's got extremely efficient solar panels. And again, Although the profit margins of this company, they are sort of low. We kind of see that as reflecting how expansive they have their sights set on growing as quickly as they can. So they're reinvesting all their profit into the company to try and expand quickly. And we recognise, actually, we think that the stock price is going to increase because of that.
You mentioned that they're, you know, investing heavily into this company. Are they quite debt leveraged? How does that sort of figure? And, you know, are they quite debt burdened, and will this sort of hinder, once they sort of grow, and will this hinder their, you know, further growth through that?
Yeah, so that's definitely the key point in solar energy. They definitely over-leverage themselves, and that can lead to one contract not going through, and then the whole house of cards collapses. Well, that's not the case with Canadian Solar. Since 2012, their debt leverage ratio has been falling. It's now actually only around 30% for such a quick-growing company. We think that's actually pretty sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Well, really, the question is, you've got two sort of solar and sort of renewable companies and sort of wind farm companies. Which do you think would be sort of maybe the better or the sort of more successful trade?
Well, I mean, as we kind of explained talking about oil prices before, I don't think it's an either-or question here. I feel like we have diversified. There will be solar power is doing so well. It dropped 80% cost since 2008, and the scale and the lowering cost is going to continue. And wind turbines, there's growth. The growth has declined in Britain, but definitely overall in the developing countries. So I think the growth will come in tandem, but I also feel that they're differentiated enough that if one industry goes, then the other's not going to be too badly affected.
Okay. George, do you have a company for us? Or
so again, well, capitalizing on the Canadian Solar, I suggested First Solar, which is an American solar company, but not to duplicate things, we decided that Canadian Solar had the better fundamentals.
Okay. Yeah. So back to Canadian Solar then. Are there any particular sort of management plans or sort of restructuring plans that you see that they could use this sort of, you know, this huge investment in growth and sort of profits and debt, any sort of way they could use this into the future? Have they mapped any out?
Yeah, I mean, just looking quickly at the management and their sort of aims and goals of the company, they're very aggressive. So definitely real focus on cutting costs. And obviously it's such a competitive industry. And then you've got Yingli Solar, which is the Chinese producer, which is the American government has said that they've been unfairly subsidized by the Chinese state. So nonetheless, whether you think that's true, it's an extremely competitive industry. And we do feel that Canadian Solar, looking at their management notes, that they're really taking a grasp of that. And cost-cutting and expansion are their main aims.
And we assume that the Chinese competitor potentially, or most likely, has much cheaper operating costs and, you know, produces a much lower cost. Why would people choose, and sort of consumers choose, the solar Canadian Solar Energy Company?
Yeah, I mean, so it is a utility business, so cost drives everything. And Canadian Solar, they've got a very good research team. Their efficiencies, they keep on breaking records. And the thing about solar producing is that it is quite capital intensive. So the sort of labor savings that you'd save in China proportionally make less of a difference. So that, coupled with the sort of innovation that Canadian Solar, puts them in good stead to compete with the Chinese.
Yeah, seeing sort of best technologies through this sort of enhanced research division.
Exactly, yeah.
Is there any other points you want to say about your companies, or also about the general sector? I know you've mentioned this huge sort of growth in potential renewables within your sector. How do you see the sort of the UK energy market looking and shaping over the next year?
Okay, well, I mean, the Tories' policies, they haven't been too great for renewables. For example, I was at a work experience with RWE trying to get approved the offshore wind farm off Skegness, and the Conservative policies have really been tough, not only on onshore wind farms, but also offshore as well. So for the UK, it's a more ambiguous picture. Obviously, there's the need after the Paris climate change talks to get renewables growing. We've got the EU constraints by 2050 as well, but it seems actually policy from the Tory government isn't too good for us.
And combined with that, constricting policy from Tory government, do you also feel that this sort of push towards fracking, sort of, you know, opening up of this fracking industry in the UK, would potentially negatively affect renewable companies within the UK?
Well, I mean, fracking, I think, again, it's just their separation between the renewables and the conventional energy and fracking. You know, we could frack as much as we can in Britain, and it's unlikely to do much of an impact on sort of local, well, world oil prices, but also the demand for renewables in Britain as well, just because they're no longer seen as substitutes. Oil and gas can be used for, you know, like heating in homes, whereas electricity, predominantly because of EU and Paris climate change agreements, is going to mostly be coming from renewables looking into the future.
Okay, well, I think that's about all the questions we have for the energy sector. It's a really interesting sort of conversation we had there, and very interesting companies. So I think now we'll just move on to sort of my division, which is currency exchange, sort of also known as Forex. I'll pass to George sort of to lead that debate.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you, guys. So, yeah, it's the Forex team, and each one of the members here, there's three in the room, they've been allocated a pair of currencies each. So we're just going to be running through what's been happening in these economies and, in result, their currencies, and then the sort of global political changes and economic changes that may be affecting the trade ideas. So we're going to start with the euro and the Great British pound. So you've been looking into these currencies. What's the effect of Brexit? Let's we start with.
Well, since the starting with the Great British pound, since 2015, we have actually been observing a steady decrease in the value of the pound against major currencies. Of course, this has been due to the referendum, which is in June, and we had actually the highlight in February, where Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, said that he was going to actually back the Leave campaign for the UK. So actually, at that time,
well, I was just going to ask, I mean, are you surprised that currency markets can be moved by one man with the name of Boris? Does that surprise you?
It's definitely a lot of power for a certain person to have, like, at that particular date, and the pound actually was dropped at its lowest level since 2009. So you're actually comparing it to crisis levels, financial crisis. So
I also think that's quite interesting, is Boris, again, as we call him today, sounds almost like Donald. So Boris again today, well, I don't know if you saw in the news, he mentioned that there's sort of leaked in the press that there's not a restraining order, but sort of a gagging order on the City Hall executives and workers, how they weren't publicly allowed to make an announcement to say that they were supporting the Stay campaign. So I think, you know, although we may take the mick out of him or, you know, ridicule him, I think he's got some, you know, serious sway in the currency markets.
Definitely, yeah. And, even though the pound did reach its lowest level since 2009, we did actually observe a rebound in the value of the pound, specifically the last 2 weeks. Last Monday, actually, the pound was able to present a five-day consecutive increase in its value, which is something we haven't seen since last June. So that's about what has been happening with the pound. But obviously, what's going to happen in the next few months is going to be focused around what's going to happen with the referendum. But just to go away a bit from the referendum, just to point out that you can expect some volatility before that, specifically on the 17th of March. The Bank of England is announcing its interest rate policy. Before this current situation in the UK markets, it was widely accepted that the Bank of England was going to present an interest rate hike. But I don't think that that's going to be the case. Like, with the current situation in the UK markets, definitely the Bank of England will not want to present any pressures on the currency. So I am expecting that they're probably not going to continue with not going to present an interest rate hike and follow the Fed. So this is going to probably lead to an unraveling of the pound. I don't think it's going to be continuing to present this increase. So, but back to the referendum. Lawrence, you mentioned a report from the HSBC. It's kind of a long report, but I just want to mention a few highlights. It's a report which the HSBC sent out, and it mainly discusses the consequences of a Brexit. This mainly involves a drop in its percentage value, 15 to 20% against the dollar. There's going to be HSBC says that it's going to present an economic slowdown. I assume this is going to be mainly caused by capital flight. inflation and labor costs are also going to increase, and generally all of these three issues are probably also going to further postpone the interest rate hike.
I think it's also important to note from the HSBC papers, they did present a case where if we do stay in the EU, that would also increase by potentially 8 to 11%. So, you know, they've got this huge volatility of, you know, huge uncertainties. We don't know what's going to happen, really, on the 23rd of June. So I think that's a very interesting day for both currencies.
I just say, so obviously you're going to be trading these currencies. What would you say in the run up to the referendum? Have you got any sort of prediction of what that's going to, what's that going to be, or is it just too uncertain?
Well, I think it's kind of similar to the interest rate hike of the Fed back in December. Up until the announcement, there was a lot of uncertainty coming out, like a lot of polls of what's going to happen, a lot of predictions, a lot of analysts coming out and telling their opinion, and it's obviously a lot of different opinions. So up until that date, I definitely think that it's going to be some a drop in the value of the pound, mostly because of the uncertainty of the pound. Investors are probably going to look elsewhere, a more certain currency.
I would also concur with this. I have a trade currently on at the moment which sort of shorts the pound against the US dollar, just because this sort of huge uncertainty leading up to June will definitely, you know, we feel that as a team as well, that really, you know, this will definitely cause a depreciation of the pound.
Interesting, yeah. So that's definitely variation, some significant political impacts on economic markets. Okay, so let's move on now to Ricardo, who's been looking at Japan and the Australian dollar. So let's first of all look at the interest rates changes. So we've had the Japanese Central Bank introduce negative interest rate changes. So what have you seen that change has been?
Well, the change that was actually introduced in January was expected to depreciate the Japan currency, so the yen, in order to promote growth after the last two lost decades, as everyone called them, because we've seen no growth or not sustained growth in Japan for the last 20 years. And unusually, it happens something that we didn't predict, because the market seemed not to believe the action from the made by the Central Bank of Japan. And actually, we've seen the yen appreciating against other currencies. So this is a big shock, I will say, because actually cutting interest rates till the negative value is something that doesn't occur very often. It's a really unlikely monetary policy. So we've seen this appreciation of the yen that gave us a lot of space out of possible trades, as I found a good trade with the British pound that is actually depreciating, as Michael said, for the Brexit news. So I will strongly recommend to short the British pound against the yen, because actually this could be a really profitable trade, and up until at least April, when a Congress in Japan is going to decide about the monetary policy after a few months of these cutting interest rates.
So given that's an unpredicted result of the lowering of the becoming negative interest rates, how sustainable do you think this appreciation is going to be? Do you think there's a time at which markets will then finally say, actually, okay, we're going to correct to what the predictions told us?
Well, we've seen the quantitative easing in Japan that didn't work in order to promote growth, and so this is another unlikely monetary policy, so they cut in interest rates until a negative value. So I will say that in the few months it should be corrected, if not on its own in April, certainly they're gonna do something about it, because they actually need growth to actually, you know.
I think what's also important to note is that partly why the reason the yen is appreciating is not just because of the negative rates, it's also because we sort of weak economic performance at the start of 2016 in the United States and also in the euro area. The sort of yen is seen often as just like a safe haven currency, where investors, you know, they go to flee volatility because Japanese stock markets are sort of stagnate. They are volatile, obviously, but not as volatile as, you know, the euro area has shown to be. So that's also potentially one of the reasons why we've seen sort of an appreciation of the yen as well.
definitely a watch area. I mean, the Japanese central bank must be kind of wringing themselves. They want to kind of depreciate their currency so they can be exporting more, and it's kind of gone the opposite way. But maybe it says more confidence about Japan, and that could be a good thing as well.
It's important to know that Kuroda, the central bank governor, also mentioned that he wouldn't go further with negative rates just yet. So, we need to sort of see what other tools they have in the bag, really, where sort of moving forward and potentially more sort of QE and other unconventional monetary policies.
Definitely a parallel with Britain and Europe. Just how many policies do we have left? You know, it's kind of it's really hard to be getting demand up at the moment.
Very uncharted territories.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, really interesting stuff. Thank you. So let's move on to America. And Lawrence, you've been looking into the US dollar. So you've got some upcoming monetary news. What's going on?
Yeah, well, I'll just backtrack a bit before that. So I'll just talk about the background. Towards the end of 2015, we saw, strengthening US dollar. Rate hike, is appreciating compared to other currencies. However, with this huge volatility and sort of actual growth concerns leading into 2016, it's depreciated against the yen, and actually depreciated against the euro as well, and some other, and the Australian dollar, which is quite a serious sort of depreciation. So we've seen, it's actually quite a weak dollar recently, and that's only really been, it is still very weak compared to the Australian dollar and the Japanese yen. The major sort of strength I've seen from the dollar is Brexit uncertainty. That's the only sort of upside buying we've seen of the dollar in comparison. And what really, I think it all hinges on this decision we have next week on the on the 15th and 16th of March, when the Fed will actually decide whether to increase rates or sort of keep them at the current level. And I think what's looking probable is that Brainard from the Open Market Committee is hinting that there's not going to be a rate hike, just sort of because there's sort of slow growth globally and slow growth in demand. And there's sort of contradictory analysis from the Fed itself. So we've got two halves of the committee saying sort of opposite things, really. And the Fed believe that, there's inflationary pressures in the States, so they really want to sort of bring it the rate hike up. So I think due to this, it's a sort of a vote, and because of this, I think we'll see a delayed rate hike sort of due to the uncertainty with the global demand.
Okay, so given that uncertainty and these conflicts of opinion, I mean, would you be willing to make a trade, or is it just too uncertain?
I'd be willing to make a trade because I think it's not uncertain. I think the rate hike will be delayed just because they won't reach an agreement. Although there is uncertainty in the markets, I'd still say that the Aussie dollar is a really strong prospect because they've got high interest rates in the moment. They're quite sort of isolated from global trade, being quite far away compared to sort of Eurozone countries. So I'd say there's definitely because of the chances of not being a rate hike very high in the US. I see that there's a buy sort of a sell potential for the US against the Aussie dollar, or a buy for the Aussie dollar, and also. On a completely other sort of factor, even though we've got quite a weak US dollar, I've also placed a trade, as I said, sort of shorting the pound against the dollar. I see sort of bearish movements here up until 23rd of March, the referendum, as Michael said.
23rd of June,
yeah.
Okay, well, interesting stuff in the markets. Looking further into 2016, we've already been seeing an increase in demand for Canadian houses, and it's due to the Donald factor, the fact that people are so scared that Donald Trump is going to become their president that they're moving to Canada. Do you think that's going to happen in currency markets as well? Is it too far away?
I think even the most liberal Americans probably move to Mexico just to escape, then they really will be isolated. But I don't think that was, is really either of those are a factor. But the Canadian economy is actually showing some strengths. I mean, you've got sort of the salt oil, as they call it, the sand oil, sorry, and that's actually they're really gaining some, even though low oil prices, they're really gaining some sort of great technology in that. Although it's quite a new sector, it's really been expanding, and they're massively reducing costs currently.
Interesting. Well, so much to think about. Thank you very much for the Forex team. Thank you to everyone for your ideas, trade ideas and comments. It's been fascinating listening. So we'll have to wait and see if your predictions are right. Next week, we'll have the industrials and tech team to tell us more about how they've been getting on. And until then, thank you for listening and goodbye.